There she is.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Barbara, how you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. It's so nice to see you. You know, this is a fun day for Boston because, excuse me, I just got a copy of Lisa Gardner's new book,
Oh,
which,
really?
yep, before she disappeared, she's going to start off her tour here, her virtual tour on January 19th. So I tend to think of you and Lisa both.
Yeah.
Boston. Do you know, I used to think of Linda Barnes. Have you seen Linda in any recent times?
Maybe a year ago, something like that. I have, so I've seen her. That's recent times. I have seen her, but it's been a long time.
She was wonderful. I thought that her series, her Boston Private
Yeah.
Eye, I'm having a mental blank. Remind me what was her name?
I can't, bl I'm blanking on it myself.
Okay. Well, there we go. Anyway, I loved them, and she toured us around Boston, you know, and it was so great. And then, of
Yeah.
course, we had Spencer, and I saw that that Kate Mattis, who had the mystery bookstore in Boston, recently died.
She just died. Yeah.
And there was a
Oh, good
whole,
store.
yeah, there was a whole of wonderful Boston writers. It's interesting how cities kind of come and go, you know. With writers, I mean, Maine now has more writers than Boston, but you wouldn't think so
Is
by
that true?
population. I think so. I think if you think about
Garrett
British
and
writers,
Lisa and
yeah, I mean, aside from
so.
Stephen King, the big gorilla, but David Rosenfeld moved to Maine. We have
Yep.
Ted Gerritsen. We have Paul Doyron, and
Yep.
yep, and over in the
Chris
coastal
Holm.
side, a woman who used to write really wonderful books that were Private Eye novels, kind of, and now she's writing what they call cozies.
Which who's that?
I'm trying to think of her name. It'll come to me. This is my, I can't think of names today. But anyway, so what's going on with you?
Well, I am sort of hunkered down in Truro working on my new book, and I'm about, I guess I'm about three quarters of the way through it, something like that. That's what it feels like.
Well, that's always good. I mean, you have been publishing in January, but you know, it's nice to take a little break maybe and get in a
Yeah.
different slot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
So are you
exactly.
having another one of your amazing ideas? I know your last book was the sort of the Purdue family, or no, the Sackler
Yeah,
family in a
exactly.
sense. And then you've been after, I mean, you've really had some wonderful foundations for your thrillers, where you've taken contemporary issues and turned them into exciting things. Your one about the judge, her one, you know,
Yeah.
reckless night in Chicago, and set
Right.
herself up for, and over the years, in fact, I remember back when you were writing very early, you were writing like The Company Man and so forth. A lot of your thrillers were built really on financial plots, weren't they? Kind of business
Yeah,
oriented.
they were. And Company Man was sort of like intrigue within a company, but it was really about the CEO of a company facing having to do all these layoffs. I remember when I wrote that book, I was really intrigued by what it must feel like to lay off all these people and be hated. And
Yes.
so in a sort of company town. And I guess I was in each of these financial things, I was intrigued by the underlying emotional situation. And I think it's pretty much each one of the financial books I can think of. Paranoia. And paranoia, I didn't think of it as financial, I thought of it as this slacker, Adam Cassidy, hates his job, working for a company, and is given an ultimatum to work against the new company as a spy. And then my publisher, St. Martin's, decided that I was a financial thriller writer. So people like to create classifications and groups and that kind of thing.
Well, it's for sales, and particularly, you know, when Barnes and Noble and Amazon are the leading booksellers, you basically have to give classifications, you know, for algorithms to work, or for, that kind of concentrated single buyer thing that Barnes & Noble had going for ages. There was one person who was the gatekeeper for what's called at Barnes & Noble. I think the new guy, James Daunt, is changing that and giving more autonomy to local stores. But
I hope so. I mean, that really, the when everything was centrally ordered, that sort of diminished the sense that a bookstore could create its own community, you know, the way you've done at Poison Pen.
Well, we triumphed over that. In fact, I recently had a discussion with our customers because we accidentally signed up, well, not accidentally, intentionally signed up for a catalog. And I'm so old and so old school, Joe, that I thought they were going to send us a print catalog that we could hand out at the bookstore. Right. To my amazement, it turned out not only to be a virtual catalog, but our younger staff, always knowing it would be virtual, sent our customer list out, you know, so all of a sudden, my normal customer list is getting this catalog, and they were really upset. Yep. And it gave me a chance to, I killed it, so that was okay. But it gave me a chance to think about why people shop at the Poison Pen. Mm-hmm. And the answer to for most of them is so that they're not just getting those kinds of books. You know, they're not getting the obvious books. They're not getting the big bestsellers necessarily. They're not having an algorithm pick their books. You know, we've always been very strong on new writers, you know, helping new authors get going, which is paid for by the more successful authors. But nonetheless, we've always wanted to do that. Speaking of which, I've now remembered the name of the woman in Maine I couldn't think of. Her name was Sarah Graves when she wrote that particular series. And it had to do with like an old house and a financial, made me think of it. A woman who'd been successful financially in New York ended up buying this old house in Maine, and then her life changed. But
was the series based on that one character and that one house?
Yeah, they were really very, very successful. But like, you know, Joe, like a lot of long-running series, eventually it came to the end. Now you've been better off with your guy because you don't write him in every book.
I've been alternating, and for me, it keeps it fresh. You know, I don't know if in publishing terms, it's a good idea, but in writing terms, every time I go to write another Nick Heller, I'm jazzed about it. I'm very excited because I haven't done it in a while.
Right. And in fact, your book, your 2020 book, House on Fire, is another Nick Heller. For whatever reason, I keep wanting to call him Nate Heller. Doesn't Max Allen Collins have a Nate Heller?
I don't know if there's a Nate Heller.
I think there is. I don't know why I keep wanting to call Nick Nate, but I do. And I think that I really do think he's out there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that Michael Connelly's hero in the Lincoln Lawyer books is Mickey Haller.
Yeah.
Not Heller, but Haller.
Right.
Close enough to confuse. Yep.
But, you know, I thought, again, Nick has taken us into some really interesting universes. There are very few people who really write financial thrillers. Michael Cyrus wrote some very good ones for Soho, and I'm pleased to see as a new book coming in March, which I haven't read yet, and I don't know what it will be, or maybe it's May, but anyway, he's coming up. Christopher Reich wrote a few kind of financial thrillers, but now he's moved a little more into
More action thriller. More sort of action, international thriller action kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, his first book that was such a success, you know, had to do with Nazi gold in Switzerland and that kind of thing. And then I'm trying to remember, there was another author who wrote financial thrillers. Can't remember, but it's always very small.
Very small. There's a guy named Michael Thomas who wrote financial thrillers.
Yeah.
And Paul Erdman. I remember Paul Erdman wrote a series of kind of explosive financial thrillers. And I remember he had been put into prison in Switzerland. And that was his selling point.
Right, but you know.
Exactly.
Love it. All right, so tell us a little bit, because the paperback of House on Fire remind us a little bit about House on Fire.
Sure. So House on Fire starts at a funeral when Nick has been told that one of his oldest friends, one of his buddies from the war, has died from an opiate overdose. And he's furious about this. It happens to so many people. He goes to the funeral, and there a woman comes up to him who says she wants to hire Nick. Her family was the family that made a fortune off of opiate drugs. And she wants to hire Nick to prove that the family did this knowing how addictive the drug was. And at first, Nick is sort of doesn't get it, why this woman would be hiring him if her own family fortune is derived from opiates. And it turns out she's the black sheep in the family, and she wants to get her father. So Nick says, I'll do it. And it sort of starts, it starts with Nick trying to figure out why his friend died of an overdose, and also to try to figure out whether the founder of the company, knowingly launched a drug, knowing that it was dangerously addictive. So this is the sort of, this is what powers the opening of the book.
Which is very effective. In fact, there have been a lot of discussions about the ethics of drug trials, or, you know, what is the human risk in trying to, do you offset a bad reaction for a few people in favor of a positive reaction for many people, certainly on our minds with the vaccine, you know, the vaccine going, and other questions. I listened to President Obama this morning. He did a very interesting interview with the Washington Post, and he pointed out that, you know, there are various considerations with the vaccine in terms of delivering it and, you know, prioritizing who gets it and international distribution and so forth. And then he mentions the kind of anti-vaxxer movement. And I've been thinking, you know, from a safety standpoint, just for the bookstore, but it would be much more important for airlines and other things, whether, you know, getting a vaccine means that you get like a photo ID that says that you've had it, because, you know, otherwise you can't really afford to let people into a space. I can't afford to let 200 people come and see you if we don't check. And so I'm wondering if we're going to run back into this American, you know, individualism where people are going to refuse. But, you know, nobody has a constitutional right to shop. So I figure that, you know, if we end up turning people away because they refuse to do that. But unfortunately, to have any kind of a photo ID card saying you've had the vaccine, that would have to be part of the program. And right. I'm wondering if that would work out, because you can't just take people's word for it. No, so how do you in fact know whether a group that's been vaccinated, that everybody in it has been vaccinated and is therefore safe to admit?
Right. And there will be people who just refuse, who consider this an infringement on their liberties, and to which I point them to Barbara, who will say, you don't have a God-given right to shop in my store.
Absolutely true. It's a bigger problem, I think, for public facilities and so forth. It's going to be a lot harder for a library or a courthouse or a hospital or something to invoke those measures. And on the other hand, you know, this would be an interesting subject for you to think about. You know, people who refuse to do that don't seem to have any problem with like buying Alexa and putting it in their home. So they've actually given up all privacy by inviting, you know, or have a smart house, or they have a smart doorbell, or, you know, they can regulate their heat.
Barb, do you have any of these? Do you have an Alexa or a...
No, I really don't. I remember Reese Bowen coming to the store. Well, we're friends. She lives here part of the time. I think we were out to lunch. And she told me, because she writes books now for Amazon Publishing in addition to Berkeley, that one of her kids gave her an Alexa for Christmas. But then Amazon thought it would be wonderful to give her an Alexa for Christmas, and she had them in different rooms. And then she realized through some conversation that they not only heard what everybody was saying, but they talked to each other.
No.
And she was just, she was just horrified. And so, she removed, I don't remember whether she removed them or not, but my husband and I have talked about that. Do we need a smart doorbell? No. You know, can we regulate our own heat? Fine.
Right.
You know, and I understand the lure if you, for example, had a second home that you were not in a lot, why having all these devices would make sense so that you could monitor it. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal every Friday has this totally over the top real estate section. You know, this is where all the billionaires in Malibu or whatever it is, you know, advertise their 12,000 square foot homes and the whole bit. But there was one guy who has a tremendous art collection. And in order to keep everything in this estate optimally, to optimal conditions for the art, he has, in fact, a super smart house. So, well, you know, because you have to regulate humidity and you have to regulate temperature. And for all I know, he has light controls, you know, blinds going up and down or whatever, not to mention the burglary possibilities, all that stuff. Now, whether he actually lives in this house, I haven't found, I didn't notice. It may just be that the art and the house are a thing over there. But now I can see why that would be worth doing if you were protecting something like that in a private setting.
Yep.
But do you see plots coming your way while we're talking?
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking also, does Jeff Bezos have, you know, all these devices in his house? He must, right?
Probably. But then, as I say, when you know, you run up against this invasion of privacy versus people voluntarily giving up their privacy for convenience or some kind of security, and it doesn't track.
People don't even think of it in those terms.
No, they really don't.
A vaccine is an infringement on their liberties, but having an Alexa in the house is just fine.
Yeah. And I noticed the other day that we have like a record total of measles cases going on because people, you know, partly it's the anti-vaxxers and then also partly it's that it's hard to get to the doctor during the pandemic. So there may be people ill with measles who would have gotten vaccinated, you know, in better times. I don't really know. A person my age has been vaccinated for absolutely everything. Because it wasn't even optional. You know, we were vaccinated for smallpox practically, you know, in the hospital, in the maternity ward. And, you know, I remember the health department used to come around. If your family doctor said you had the measles or the mumps or chicken pox, whooping cough or scarlet fever, I think those were the big five in the suburb of Chicago. You know, your family doctor told the health department and they came around and they banged up a quarantine notice on your house and you were not allowed to go to school until you were completely clear of all these childhood diseases. And nobody questioned it. It wasn't but today I don't see how that would happen.
I remember when I was a kid, there was a scare about polio. So I was vaccinated against polio, but what a big deal it was when that vaccine was suddenly available after years of the terror of catching polio and what it could do to you.
It haunted my whole childhood and teenage years. I went to Stanford in 1958 and I think Salk, was it like 56 or something?
Yeah, 56.
The Salk vaccine had come along just sort of at the end of my time in high school. But, you know, we used to have to worry about going to Lake Michigan, you know, to the beach in the summer and all when there would be these polio surges. And, you know, and then Salk came along and polio more or less fell away. But I was reading a book about the Grand Canyon the other day. Some woman has written an interesting book about Grand Canyon Village. And one of it's the urgent care center, if you will, in Grand Canyon Village. And this young doctor is confronted with somebody. She cannot work out a diagnosis. And an older doctor comes in and takes one look and does this, and he says, well, it's the plague. Because, in fact, the bubonic plague is actually active in the Four Corners. And this guy was a tourist that had been to that Four Corners area I'm trying to remember whether it's the rodents or whatever it is. Anyway, and then I'd come over to Grand Canyon Village, but nobody really knows plague. And it took the old doctor to say, oh, it's plague. And there's actually treatment for it now. But imagine, you know, going back to the 14th century when people got the plague and there you were.
Right. And you just died. There wasn't
no vaccine. Yep. Well, we've had lots of plagues in our time, political, medical, you know, all kinds. And there we are. Well, tell us what you're working on. That'd be fun to know, a little preview.
I'm working on what I guess is called a psychological thriller, because the main character is a female psychiatrist in Boston who's involved with a homicide that sort of powers the plot. And I have spent a lot of time talking to women psychiatrists to sort of gather the details and the texture and the color. And as you know from my books, I love this sort of stuff. I love plunging into another world, someone else's world, and sort of learning what it's like. What is it like to be a psychiatrist? What's it like to deal with your patients? What is it like when a patient is difficult? How do you handle that? So I'm sort of, it's the same, you know, it's the same thing I did in writing Company Man, where I spent time with CEOs to get a sense of what their daily life was like. I just sort of, each one of my books plunges into a different world and sort of shows you from the inside what it's like. And that comes from my being really curious about what it's like, you know?
Well, you've always loved research. I've known that about you forever. When you wrote the book that came before, I think it was the one before House on Fire about the judge, you had to look into legal procedure and legal ethics and so forth. But Boston is thick with attorneys. So did you just co-opt one?
I did. I actually gathered together a group of five different judges, all female judges, and sat down with them and asked them all kinds of silly, trivial questions. But, you know, what time do they get to work and what do they wear under the robe and all this kind of stuff. And this was my way of sort of making it feel concrete and real. And I loved it. The research was great.
I bet you didn't ask them if they would sleep with an attorney while they were away at a legal conference. That was probably your own take on the whole thing.
That was my own, exactly.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So how is Boston at the moment? You know, East Coast cities have, like, just like Phoenix, have really had big ups and downs in the pandemic. Are you guys back under siege?
Yeah, Boston is kind of dead. I mean, you know, it's... a lot of people seem to have moved out. And where I am right now on Cape Cod, the real estate market is hot because people are buying sort of vacation homes or second homes as their primary residence and selling their condos back in Boston. So there's kind of this migration out of the city and into the sort of rural areas in Massachusetts.
So Boston, well, I think that's true all over. It's not just in Massachusetts. I mean, Scottsdale is acquiring, you know, of course, nobody's bothering to ask where the water will come from. But aside from that, you know, we're having a huge real estate boom, and certainly either home renovation, which for a lot of people, actually we've done that because, you know, we've had a little more time, done some work on the house that was seriously needed. We've even ordered a generator after thinking about what it would be like to be in California during all these brownouts and all, and realizing that we would lose everything. If we went for 3 or 4 days in July in Phoenix without electricity, everything would be destroyed. You know, we had this horrible hot summer, so the whole contents of the house would be...
Do you have brownouts in Scottsdale?
Not normally. We do have a monsoon season, and sometimes we didn't have any rain this summer. Sometimes in a monsoon season, lightning or the storm, you know, will not all utilities are underground by a long shot. will knock it out. But generally, it can be restored relatively quickly. But, if you have the kind of brownouts they're having in California, not so good. Anyway, just the combination of California, the fires, the brownouts, and the record heat that we had here. We had half our year has been over 100 degrees this year.
Is that right? So you normally have cooler winters and springs.
Well, we used to have 4 bad months and 8 good months, and then it got to be 5 and 7. And this year, we'll be lucky if it's 6 and 6 because the heat continued into November instead of ending at the end of August.
Yes. But
anyway, it's just made us more conscious of how dependent we are on electricity. And then, somebody like Jeffrey Deaver comes along and writes a thriller about, taking out the power grid or something, and you go,
Yeah,
you can learn a lot from reading thrillers.
you get nervous about a lot of things reading thrillers, right?
Yeah, well, you do. And I mean, a generator, because we have natural gas, a generator is not that big in investment as compared to what could happen if we didn't have one. But all I'm saying is that I think people become a lot more conscious of their homes and how their homes function and where they want to live. I mean, you've been working at home forever. Rather than in an office. So for you, working at Cape Cod is not a big deal. But for somebody that's been, let's say, in Hartford in the insurance business, to suddenly find themselves at home is all a different thing.
Although, I don't work at home. I have in Boston, I have an office outside the home, few blocks away. And it's an apartment that I use as an office. And here in Truro, I have a little, the old barn was moved down the hill, and that's what I use as my office. But I've never worked at home. I just can't do it. And I admire writers who can, but it's tough.
I have talked to a number of British authors, and apparently in Britain, most homes come equipped with a garden shed. And so I was talking to her, I'm trying to remember, Ellie Griffiths the other day, and she said to me that the wind was really howling and she was down there in the shed in the garden. Mm. And if the Zoom went bad, it would be because the weather had attacked her. But I actually have worked at home for over 20 years when I'm not at the store, but it's an office. I mean, it's not part of the regular part of the house. It's set up for one. So, I feel as though I've gone to, and I get up, I get dressed, I start my day at home, but then I get all dressed up as though I were going to work. And then I come down the hall and work in my office and then drive down to the store. So, it's what you're doing.
So, and in fact, I emailed you about this. So I wonder how COVID has affected you and your life.
Well, not a huge amount. We're lucky that we have a very big house. So we haven't had, and where we live, you've been to visit my house. So you know, it's in a city, but it really doesn't feel like one. It's a relatively small community. So that hasn't changed very much. The kids are grown, we don't have children at home to contend with. Dogs we do have, and the dogs take a lot of care. It's been strange that the store, the bookstore, the Poison Pen has actually benefited from the pandemic.
It has.
Well, but Joe, we've been running the store with programming, video programming and all the rest of it. Yeah. My first video event was in 1995. Huh. We found the old videotapes from the Scottsdale Library. So P.D. James in 1995 kicked us off as a virtual bookstore. And you've been there when we have had the cameras running, and you've been talking to a live audience, but you've also been on Facebook.
Right.
So we didn't really have to do anything differently. We still ship books to authors, and it's more of a pest because it's harder to get books at your house and sign them and send them to us than if you showed up at the store. And so we've had to cut the quantities, but we virtually sold, and we have basically sold out of all the event books that we have done, thanks to the authors who've been kind enough to do things. And in many cases, the demand has gone up.
So, what about walk-in traffic though? That's gone, right?
Well, yeah, we closed to walk-in traffic for several months. We reopened it right after Labor Day by appointment. Yep. No, I'm sorry, it was at the end of September by appointment. And then we realized, curiously, that our regular customers who were used to doing everything by phone or internet or watching stuff, you know, didn't take advantage of the appointments. And so the people that came into the store were people basically wandering around Scottsdale looking for something to do. And that was fine. And I'm sure we gained some new customers, but yeah, we just shut down again because Thanksgiving here is going to be a super spreader because of all the people, you know, taking it. It'll be that way through Christmas because Phoenix and Scottsdale traditionally been a huge holiday destination. Yeah. And people are flocking in or they're moving in from to get away from the weather and the lockdown and so forth. And right. So we decided that we would give up very little by just closing to browsing. So the store's been operating as it always has with the staff in the 24/7 in terms of internet orders and other stuff. But I don't think that not being open for browsing is going to be as sad as that. I mean, we miss people. That's the really hard part. It's weird to work in isolation and not see. I was just noticing a moment ago that we sold a book to a couple that moved here from New Mexico because they were commuting to all of our events and loving it. And now they've apparently moved to Virginia. And I'm going to guess it was a family decision. They probably had a child or something that lives in Virginia, but I'm going to write to them and say, you know, so I think there's going to be dislocation of, you know, when we go back, when we can go back to live, we're not going to see a lot of the more familiar faces. People will have changed their
habits,
you know, they would have, well, yeah, not just their habits, but their lives. I mean, there are people whose finances are going to be ruined. There are people who've gotten sick. There are people who chose to relocate rather than live on their own. So it'll really be different in, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what we can't do anything about it. But when I say the store has benefited, because virtual events have no geographical boundaries, and we don't charge for ours. I mean, I've been under a lot of pressure from at least one publisher to ticket everything, but I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. As long as we're doing okay, I would rather support authors by exposing them to the largest audience that we can.
Right. You know,
people who only read audiobooks or listen to audiobooks or read digitally or other things. And we've had
e-books,
we've had huge numbers, you know, for some of them. I mean, many thousands. Sometimes I think the worst number we've had is somewhere in the 700s or something, but generally it's at least 1,000 and often multiples of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that sense, it's been like a big marketing thing because people, we did a really fun thing with Brad Thor. We had a discussion club 3 months after we launched his book in July and sold it through and all that was great. But Brad and I recognized that there were aspects of the thriller that we couldn't, as you know, you can't talk about it at a book launch because it's going to ruin it, right?
Reading
the book. So we thought it'd be fun to get together and do a discussion after everybody had read the book. And we had to learn webinar. Brad volunteered to be a guinea pig. He didn't care, you know, it was all going to be fine. And then we recognized while we were talking what a global community we had. We had a guy from New Zealand who emailed his question in case he wasn't able to stay awake long enough. We had some guy from Bulgaria asking questions. We had people all over the world as part of this Brad Thor discussion club. And that is really been exciting. And, you know, so if you think about it as a kind of an amazing marketing opportunity where doing these things exposes you to all kinds of new people that you wouldn't, you know, I mean, Janet Ivanovich, you know, for years didn't tour because she liked to do like one ginormous event in New Hampshire where she would get 2,000 or 3,000 people and stay up all night signing books and so forth. Right. And we launched her book on November 2nd, and she's had like over 5,000 views, and you know, she was able to reach a much bigger audience than even when she was doing these mega events in the casino. So it's really changed how things work. I'm hoping
to accelerate the changes.
Yeah, so I'm planning to keep the good parts of the virtual world when we go back to live events, and the vaccine news is all encouraging. But I think that we can do stuff like those book discussion groups, or we can talk to authors in other countries. We've done a lot of events with British authors, Australian, Swedish. We're going to launch Lars Kepler from wherever they live in Sweden next week. Yeah. And so it's given us a chance to talk to authors that might not come to visit us, or to put authors together where it wouldn't have made much sense for their individual publishers, you know, to put them together. I mean, we had Lee Child launch Mark Billingham, and then Mark Billingham turned around and Richard Osman, you know, both of them in England. And, you know, we wouldn't normally have had Mark and Lee in the store at the same time. You know, it would have been somewhat bizarre. We're navigating where we are. And then I think we have to give a lot of thought to navigating where we're going. And I think that this technology came along at just the right time.
So are you noticing any kind of trends or any kind of changes in the book market?
Well, I think the blockbuster book is becoming more more impactful than it was. It's harder to get attention for smaller books and smaller authors. Our paperback sales have just about fallen away. It's without people coming into the store and picking them up, thinking about getting on a plane, you know, all that kind of thing. I think that our sales anyway for paperbacks have been different. It's also doesn't make any sense to ship paperbacks. You know, they get damaged. There's not enough money in them to offset the shipping costs and so forth. So we've done a lot of group paperback events and all, but doing them with the understanding they aren't going to make us any money. But I think it's harder to launch a new author right now. And so I think more attention inevitably is going to more established authors because, you know, they're going to have an audience, and we all kind
sure
of
sure thing, sure thing for publishers.
We're going to go from the big five publishers to the big four here any day. Yeah. Somebody buys Simon & Schuster. And so the consolidation at the top of the publishing game obviously is shrinking things as well.
Yeah, that is not good. That's not good.
No, it really isn't. But these are all forces that sale has nothing to do with the pandemic. It has everything to do with Summer Redman and his empire and it breaking up in the same way that when Robert Maxwell died, however he died. overboard, but whether it was intentional or accidental, we don't know.
Yeah.
But that put, you know, Scribner into Simon & Schuster. So, you know, this sort of combination of publishing imprints and publishing branches has been going on for a long time. But I think that the more limited opportunities that we have in the pandemic are making it sales opportunities anyway, are making it harder. On the other hand, people have been buying more books than ever because the competing forms of entertainment are either not available or incredibly expensive or perceived as dangerous. And I think therefore there's been more of a reading audience right now than there
That's
has been. Yeah, it's been for a long time. And without that much else to do, people have been willing to watch things on screen.
Yep.
But I don't think that will continue when people can get back out again. I think they will watch some things, but it's not going to be nearly as concentrated, I think, as it is right now.
So that sort of Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV sort of browsing each menu to see what's available, right? It reminds me of when the old days when you used to walk into a video store to decide what to rent that night. and you just get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's absolutely true. I think movie theaters are going to have tremendous problems maintaining themselves. People have gotten much more used to watching things at home, and the number of streaming services has dramatically increased.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, while you might be paying, and also if you've signed up and you're paying X amount of money a month for this service and that service, because they can get quite expensive, then to go out and pay more money to go to a movie in a theater,
right?
You know, is going to be even more. So I was interested to see that a couple of the big airlines were anticipating a 15% reduction in business travel. And I thought, oh, they've got to be way off. I mean, I can't imagine it's only 15%. I would have guessed it would be closer to 50.
Yeah. It's got to be more than 15%.
Well, that's just a projection. But, you know, if you think about business meetings and so forth and travel, now that we have this, Skype was one thing, but now that we have Zoom and these interactive things with chat features and all the rest of it, I think an awful lot of business meetings will, you know, will take place in a virtual world. So it will certainly impact the airlines and how they operate.
So what happens when publishers decide that the virtual tour is the way to go, even though, you know, we have a vaccine, COVID is over? Publishers may well decide that the virtual tour is the future.
Well, I think to some degree it will be. A lot of it may then come down to authors who want to do their own travel. Some of it is volume. I mean, I won't name them, but we've had several authors who have chosen, because the number of books is so tremendous, they have just chosen to come here rather than deal with it at home. I mean, you don't want a pallet, you know, I mean, big orders shipped by truck on wooden pallets, if they drop that at the end of your driveway, you have to go down there and splinter up the pallet and haul the books up there. I mean, Johnson sent us this absolutely hilarious photo because he lives in a big property in Santa Fe, and UPS is at the bottom of the hill. So he has a tractor that he piled all the cartons in and hauled them up the hill and signed the books, you know, went down the hill. So would John rather come here than do that again? Yes. And so I don't know whether publisher-sponsored tours will be the thing or whether it will be more in terms of authors. But then again, the cost of travel being what it is, it may also mean that the blockbuster books will continue to dominate because it's authors making enough money to underwrite doing that.
On tours.
I don't know. I mean, I we're just sort of marching along a step at a time and we'll have to deal with, but the world won't be the same when we emerge from this. There will be definite.
You're probably right. Changes.
So, you know, it'll just depend. Well, please keep in touch in regard to the progress of your book and when you think it might come out. And don't go away. I'm going to stop recording by saying thank you very much for spending a little time with me.
Thank you, Barbara. Good to talk to you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.